Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Viene Madison que le pega al arquero. La pelota ingresó.
No
ingresó. Señoras y señores, ahí está Aaron Ramsdale.
Dos salvadas monumentales de Ramsdale, ¿eh? Monumentales, tremendo.
Señoras y señores, ahí está Aaron Ramsdale. ¡Pega!
No. Monumentales de Ramsdale, ¿eh? Monumentales.
¡Pega!
No.
Señoras y señores, Aaron Ramsdale.
Aaron Ramsdale. Dos salvadas.
Aaron Ramsdale.
Dos salvadas.
Señoras y señores,
monumentales de Ramsdale, ¿eh? Monumentales, tremendo.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, goodly morning to you.
Goodly morning to you too, Andrew. And happy Valentine's.
Oh, happy Valentine's to you as well. Should I say top of the goodly morning to you, James?
Ah, well put, my Irish kin.
Have you been inducted? Are you back in? Are you one of us
now?
Yes,
they did the ceremony. They dunked me in the Guinness and they pulled me out and I was Irish.
Amazing.
Have you explained my absence in my... Absence. Does anyone... Have I said on here that I was going to Ireland?
I think we said, yeah, you were talking maybe... I don't know if it was here or if it was on one of the Patreon ones, but I did mention on Friday that we were not doing an Arscast Extra post-Wolves because you were, you know, going to be in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it was. So, I mean, did you get to see the quarry?
I actually drove past the quarry. I went with my brother and my dad went, oh, look, a quarry. And I said, I could tell you a thing or two about that quarry. I've done my research on the quarry. It was very funny because we were going to... My dad wanted to kind of investigate our heritage in Ireland, particularly in a very, very small town, would be a stretch, place called Bohola in County Mayo. And the day before we went, he sent me a TripAdvisor link that had the headline, things to do, top 10 things to do in Bohola.
There were 10?
And you clicked on it. And it literally said, there are no results. but despite that,
yeah,
we had a good time. And, you know, it was interesting. I mean, literally we walked into this small town and said our name was McNicholas and were sort of inundated with people throwing history at us. Had a walk around a graveyard, saw a bunch of people called James McNicholas buried, which was quite strange.
It's a good omen for our season.
Yeah, very much so. And I found an Arsenal bar. We were staying in a tiny town called Kiltimach. I apologise to the people of Mayo for that pronunciation. And they had a place called the Tavern Bar. And yeah, the guy who owns it is a lifelong Arsenal fan and it's decorated with Arsenal memorabilia. So that was quite satisfying.
Wow.
And I kind of home from home for me. But the most interesting thing, I think you'll agree, is that before I went, I bought this book and it's called Mayo Folk Tales.
Right.
Rather than immerse myself in true history, I guess I feared there wouldn't be sufficient true history that I thought the folk stuff, that's going to be interesting.
Right.
And I was reading through it. It's a lovely book. It's quite funny because at the start, the writer is like, I really want to place on thanks to my wife for her stunning illustrations in the book. And I have to be honest, it's a lovely book, but it is accompanied by what I can only describe as the scrawlings of a child, intermittently. Like, I mean, well, the thanks in the introduction was really not necessary. I think, you know, clip art would have sufficed, but there you go. But I was reading through and there's a whole section about birds.
Uh-oh. You know,
it begins, "There are many things that hide from the light of day, things that go bump in the night. Once the sun goes down, they come creeping out of the shadows. All of us have felt a shiver up our back, seen something out the corner of our eye, and yet when we look, we find there is nothing there. Many birds were believed to carry dead souls, or were believed to be dead people incarnate." And then over the page, along with a frankly terrifying drawing, captioned "Soul Gatherers," is the following sentence. "Magpies were regarded as the repositories of the souls of evil-minded or gossiping women."
Wow.
The whole magpie phenomenon explained.
Laid bare.
The trip to Mayo was worth it. I did find the truth I was seeking.
Do you worry, perhaps, that somehow that the universe has set you on a path via, like, you know, you've spoken before about your dad and your brother being Chelsea fans, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you chose this beautiful red and white path instead, which led you to start a blog about Arsenal, which led to a podcast about Arsenal, from which somehow this magpie thing came to life. And then, on a quest to rediscover your Irish roots with said father and brother, you unearthed the real truth about the magpies. I mean,
it all comes full circle.
It's fate, surely.
Quite funny as well, I think, that these evil spirits are the reincarnated souls of not murderers, not, you know, cold-blooded killers, gossiping women.
Well, I mean, is there any more true evil in this entire world than gossiping women? Because, I mean,
I don't know what that says about historical Mayo society, that was regarded as the great reincarnated evil.
Yeah.
The women will come back and talk among themselves in the form of birds.
Men never gossip, of course. We would never do anything.
Never, ever. Never, ever. There's not even there's certainly not a whole industry based around sports-related transfer gossip. So, there you go. Mayo was excellent. And I have to say, it was quite a good omen because from an Arsenal perspective, the past few days could not really have gone better. I mean, I was at Wolves. I went to the game and then flew basically straight away to Ireland. And then the results that have come in since.
Holy,
I mean, everything's coming up Arsenal.
Everything's coming up Millhouse. Let me ask you this, because we haven't spoken since the Wolves game. Mm-hmm. Did you disrespect football? Did you cast shade on the entire town of Wolverhampton or Borough or whatever the fuck it is? Mm. Did you shame yourself and Arsenal fans in general by, at the end of the game, did you celebrate a win?
Just a bit, Andrew.
Just a bit.
I've got to tell you, so Molineux, the away fans, I've never been before, are in the Steve Bull stand, and it's not behind the goal, right? It's sort of along the lower tier of one of the side stands, if you will.
That's unusual,
It is very unusual, and it's an unusually good view of a game. Yeah, so one sort of unfortunate side effect of that is because the fans are kind of spread out in a long, thin rectangle rather than a tight square, if you will. It's not as easy to generate the sort of raucous atmosphere you normally associate with away fans. But one of the interesting upshots of this deployment is that behind the away fans, immediately behind them, is a big Perspex wall. And behind that are a series of Wolves supporting boxes.
Ah, the corporates.
So yeah. But I mean, not too corporate. I mean, these were full of people in replica shirts who are clearly very invested in the outcome of the game.
Right.
And what that meant was that everything that happened was kind of a direct interplay between us in the away end and these guys in the boxes behind who were increasingly apoplectic about time wasting, fouling, and there was a lot of sort of gesturing of like, you come in this box through this passport, you know, through this perspex wall, and we'll see. You know, there was like real palpable fury and anger. And it just increased and increased across the 90 minutes until, like, I mean, at the end of the game, it was just sort of a standoff of, like, Arsenal fans being like, come and get us, you know, taunting these guys, these caged Wolves fans, baiting them. So it was incredibly fun and satisfying. And, yeah, I really celebrated it because also there was the release of a lot of tension.
Yes.
I mean, I only watched the highlights of that game yesterday when I got back, and I had blocked out quite how stressful some of it was. The elation washed over me and washed away the memory, I think, of that last half hour or so.
Yeah, I mean, I watched your post-match video where you were talking about that sort of phenomenon when you're in the ground, when you're at the game, it maybe doesn't feel quite as stressful as it does when you're removed from it,
true.
When you're watching on TV. And I do think there's something to that, you know, because it was pretty stressful. It really was.
Oh.
But this has become a whole big thing now, hasn't it? This idea of like, what can you celebrate? What should you celebrate? How should you celebrate? To what extent should you celebrate? Like, there are levels that are acceptable when you win 1-0 away from home on a Thursday night, apparently. I mean, I saw the Wolves' Twitter account. They beat one of the results, obviously, that was very good for us over the weekend, was Wolves beating Spurs, which, of course, is hilarious. But then their Twitter account tweeted, celebrating in the right way. And with, like, italics on the right, as if, like, there's some, I don't know, Geneva Convention as to how you are allowed to celebrate, whether, you know, the players, you know, should they celebrate? Fans, should they celebrate? Should the players and fans celebrate together? Should there be any kind of intercourse, if you like, between players and fans at the end of a 1-0 win, which, you know, all of that kind of stuff. It is quite bizarre the way this has gone. It sort of reminded me a little bit of the postponement, you know, the way...
Yeah.
When all the games were being postponed because of COVID cases and injuries and everything else, it was like, well, games being postponed because of COVID cases and injuries. And then it was Arsenal was like, oh my God, the game is being postponed because of COVID and injuries. What a disgrace Arsenal are. And it seems to me that there's an element of that. And maybe we're a bit sensitive to that kind of stuff as Arsenal fans. But I don't think I've ever really seen that kind of, you know, overt policing of people's emotions over something that is clearly very emotional.
If Arsenal had just won the game in a routine fashion, you know, they'd been 2-0 up and controlled it, 11 men, got over the line, I don't think... And then they'd celebrated in that fashion. I think that would have been reasonable to say maybe that's a bit excessive. But in the circumstances, they were massive, massive points.
Mm.
And they have proven to be even massiver, given what's followed over the next few days. But, you know, it's a real backs-to-the-wall effort. A huge amount of tension being let out of that full-time whistle. A big, significant win against a team who were close to us in the table.
They could have gone above us.
You know, we talked about it as a possible six-pointer, really. I just think any kind of you know, attempt to sort of downplay the significance of that or poo-poo the celebrations is ridiculous, really. And as Arsenal fans, you know, we should absolutely tell people where to go, because I think we knew it was big.
Mm.
And actually, the way events have fallen out over the subsequent few days have proven that to be the case. I think those celebrations even feel more justified a few days on, because that win put Arsenal in a really strong position. So yeah, they can all get fucked, really, can't they?
They absolutely can. And I do think perhaps that, you know, the as you say, the importance of the game, the 6-point element to it, was probably why Wolves were annoyed by it as well. It wasn't so much the celebrations, they were pissed off because they lost. I did enjoy this from Steve Pye on Twitter, who was at 1980s Sports Blog, and he said, if we beat Wolves at home, not an easy task, as a certain club discovered yesterday. Should the club play Celebration by Kool and the Gang in the stadium at the end of the match, or should we be above that kind of thing? And I absolutely think we should.
Absolutely. Yeah, let's get working on the stadium DJ to make that happen. I think, yeah, I mean, I've seen people saying we should all be on the pitch. Full firework display, you know, everything. I mean, yeah, look, I think it might have some needle to it, that game now, based on these comments and everything that's fallen out, even though Wolves did us a big favour this weekend. I think, yeah, we should absolutely go for it if we beat them. And it's an interesting prospect, isn't it? I mean, two home games coming up now. Brentford and Wolves, who we beat not long ago in Wolves' case. Brentford haven't been in great form. We really owe them a result after what happened on the opening day.
For sure.
So, yeah, I mean, listen, I'm certainly not getting carried away with top four percentage odds. Do you take any comfort from those? I don't know if you've seen, but the statisticians tell us we've tipped over the 50% probability mark in terms of reaching the top four.
Yeah, I find it hard to take any great comfort from that, to be honest, because, you know, they're stats and, you know, I'm not dismissing stats. I think, you know, they're a useful part of football, but they're not imbued with the magic of foresight or anything like that. You know, football is quite random and all kinds of shit can happen. So, no, but I do look at our place in the table and feel encouraged and confident that we are where we are. And after the weekend, you know, we should mention that Man United dropped points, Spurs dropped points, West Ham dropped
points.
After
doing so in midweek as well, let's remember.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's been a really good week. And I think we've talked a bit about the clarity of what we have ahead of us and how that could be a very useful aspect to what we need to get done between now and the end of the season, right? And I think this sort of hammers it home, like, points on the board versus games in hand is a discussion that you can have one way or the other. But when I look at what we've got to do, and when you look at the table, I think what a way this is to sharpen even more the focus of the team, which I think also is worth pointing out was reflected in the celebrations on Thursday night against Wolves, because it said something to me about how invested they are in what we've got to do. You know what I mean? And
yeah,
this last couple of years have been really difficult for Arsenal. We know most of the reasons why. We know where we've been in the table. And I wonder sometimes if when the stakes are a bit lower, subconsciously, is it difficult to get yourself properly up for games, if you know what I mean? Like, last season we went on a good run towards the end and we ended up finishing eighth, and that was kind of about as high as we were going to finish. We didn't want to finish seventh because we didn't want to be in that Europa Conference League thing, right? But when the stakes are higher, when there is very, very definitely a top four place to play for, I wonder, you know, is that a really positive thing? I mean, obviously it is. I know it's reductive to say it, but the fact that you've got something that's more tangible ahead of you and the potential that a good run and a good end to the season brings in terms of what you're going to do next season, where you're going to play, how you're going to play, you know, what it could mean for recruitment, Champions League football. These guys look hungry. They look up for it, all of that kind of stuff. But then, you know, is it augmented by the fact that you have this pretty substantial thing to play for?
Yeah, I think when there is a finishing line of sorts within sight, Arsenal tend to be better. I mean, I think that's a big part of why they've been a good cup team in recent history. Mm. You know, when there's a kind of tangible prize and a clear path to get there, it does seem to improve focus and performances a bit, generally speaking. But it's interesting. I was listening to the radio at the weekend, and I think it was Five Live, and they were talking about fourth place, and they were saying, you know, nobody seems to want it. The way these results are going, nobody wants it. And I felt like sort of saying back, well, Arsenal wants it. Yeah. And I do think that amidst our sort of disappointing January in terms of the results in the cups and the lack of signings, I do think it's been slightly lost that generally our league form didn't suffer too much. We only played two games, a loss and a draw. And granted, we would have liked more from those, but it's by no means disastrous. When it comes to the actual form table in the Premier League, we're doing all right. You know, we're sort of on track. And that the games in hand situation has dramatically changed. I mean, it feels like not long ago, everyone was telling me Spurs have got 10 games in hand or something. Don't worry, you know, once they, as soon as they win those, they'll run away with
it. Yeah, get their 30 points, yeah.
Yeah, hasn't quite worked out exactly. We've all seen probably that clip on social media of Hargreaves and Rio Ferdinand listing off Ranić's next 10 games. Win, 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 win. Should be 30 points. Hasn't happened.
I haven't seen that, but...
Really? Yeah. It's great. It's on my timeline. And they go through 10 fixtures and they say something like, they're all winnable. They should be winning all those games. I think they're on track for... maybe less than 20 of the 30 available.
This is Ferdinand's new Ole's at the wheel.
Very much so. Very much so. So that's something to keep an eye on. I think they've got one more game remaining in that run. I think things look healthy. I mean, I wouldn't, like you, I'm not too swayed by the probability stats because do they factor in the probability of Granit Xhaka being sent off for something insane or, you know, somebody important getting injured or us just inexplicably making a big mistake? I don't know. But we look in a good shape. And I think we, as a club, it's quite a sort of galvanising thing, really. I think people were a bit deflated off the back of January, but events of the last few days have swiftly dealt with that.
Yeah. I mean, the flip side of the opportunity ahead of you is the pressure, isn't it? You know, you, as the season progresses, and if you can keep up with the teams ahead of you, there is an element of pressure that you're going to have to deal with. And that can be inhibiting at times for teams. Like, you know, this game against Brentford at the weekend, and we're looking at it going, look at the results that have happened this week, and they're brilliant for us, but we have to make sure we capitalize on that. We have to make sure that this opportunity that has presented itself is one we get the maximum from. So it's another aspect to how we view the potential of this team to finish in the top four is that, like, it feels like for a while or quite a while, a lot of what we've been doing in the Premier League is playing catch up, if you know what I mean, trying to make up for a poor start to the season or a poor run of form so we can haul ourselves back into, a relatively, in inverted commas, decent position. Whereas I think what we're looking at now is we could be the leading pace horse. Setter. Yeah. The pace setter of this sort of pack of teams behind the top two, top three. And that is a different position to be in, and that's certainly something that we're going to have to contend with.
Yeah, and it's interesting, even not having many games, that brings a different kind of focus and scrutiny. You know, Arsenal have got 9 days or something to be thinking about this Brentford match, which in one respect is a positive, but again, just could crank up that pressure a little bit. I think we have to try and be front runners, pace setters at this point in the fixture list because it's relatively kind, famous last words, etc. But two home games, Brentford and Wolves. Then we go to Watford. Then we host Leicester. Neither of those teams playing particularly well. Then it's Aston Villa away. I mean, you know, they've improved a bit under Steven Gerrard, but that's a game Arsenal really should be thinking about winning. Crystal Palace away. Brighton at home. Southampton away. You know, there are difficult games to be rearranged against Spurs, against Chelsea. We host Manchester United, but there is also a winnable set of fixtures in front of us. I'm not going to do the Rio Ferdinand thing of win. But the opportunity is there, right, for us to really accumulate some points. I think your point about pressure, though, is really interesting. And I was just having a conversation with Amy Lawrence about the sendings off that Arsenal have been getting, and she mentioned thinking that this is quite an emotional team. And I think actually that as a thesis sort of explains quite a lot about this season. I think this is a deeply emotional team. And I think you see that in some of the red cards and the decisions they make. You also see that in things like the celebrations that we saw at Molineux. I think you see that in the connection that is building between supporters and fans. I think when we sort of think, oh, we really care about this team and we really sort of empathise with them and we feel that connection, I think their palpable emotion is inevitably part of that. The other side of that coin is that you know, it's a fine line between emotion being a very positive influence and it being a negative one. And handling that pressure, and you can see how much they want it, how much it means to them all. Their ability to kind of keep that on the boil without it bubbling over, and Arteta's ability to manage that is going to be critical, isn't it, really, between now and the end of the season.
I mean, what you would say, though, is that this is where you want to be. This is where you would want to be. Like, if you're striving for progression, if you're striving to improve, dealing with the pressure of expectation is far better, I think, than dealing with the pressure of underachievement and having to respond and having to bounce back and all that kind of stuff. So if we're looking at this as something we have to deal with, it's a measure of, like, are you going to get there or not? Because you have to get on top of this. You have to be able to deal with it to make the kind of progress that we want to see the team make. So I'm not sanguine or whatever, but I'm just really interested to see how well they do in these games. I think that's a really good point about it being a slightly emotional team. And I haven't asked you about what you thought of the what you thought of the sending off the other night. Like, what was the reaction inside the ground from fans just standing there going, what the fuck? And well, with the cold light confusion. Of day, and in the cold light of day, what are your thoughts on it?
We were really confused. I was confused, certainly, about what had gone on, just because, you know, it was difficult to follow. It was on the other side of the pitch as well. In the cold light of day, I think, speaking of emotional, I think the referee made a slightly emotional decision.
Yeah.
I think that he was very frustrated. If you think about it, when a team sort of time wastes, the referee pays a price for that. Like, you know, when one of the teams is time wasting, let's say it's the away team, the home fans get on the away team's back, but more than that, they get on the referee's back.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's a problem for them, in a way. It becomes their problem, and of course that's the job and they should handle it. But I do wonder if that, because Arsenal did sort of start some of that stuff quite early on, and there was a bit of cynicism about the way we played in the second half, I thought. And I do wonder if it got on top of the referee and he felt like, you know, emotionally emboldened to do something that you wouldn't really ordinarily see happen.
Yeah. I mean,
it's very, very unusual. So I think Martinelli was quite harshly done by. The other side of that is that I do think the situation is what it is. You know, Arsenal are a team where referees, I think, do feel, how can I put it? The stakes around giving Arsenal a red card are lower, it seems to me, than they are with other teams. It's like, they're that red card team.
Yeah.
So what's another one?
Yeah.
And I do think that's playing into a kind of unconscious or conscious, depending on your, you know, beliefs, bias there. And I think the problem is Arsenal have to deal with that. And we can't just let that situation self-fulfill. We have to try and seize some control and ultimately stop giving referees the opportunity to make these decisions.
Sure. I thought Arteta's comments were quite interesting after the game, because, you know, everyone seemed to think it was initially about, like, the red cards that we've received. I think when you look at them, we've only had three in the Premier League. It feels like we've had way more, but we've had three. And I think there were a couple of other teams at three, a load of teams on two. Of course, the only team in the world that hasn't had a red card this season is Burnley, which is kind of kind of amazing. But there you go. But I think part of the frustration from an Arsenal fan's perspective is what hasn't been done with other incidents in games where we seem to get punished all the way to the maximum. Yeah. Like, that was what happened to Martinelli, was the maximum punishment that you can pick up in like 5 seconds on a football pitch. You know, it doesn't happen that way so rarely. I think there was one example of a game, a Northern Ireland player got sent off for something very similar.
But equally, there was a clip going around on social media of Davy Proper of Brighton, I think with the same referee, committed 2,000.
Well, that's it. Like, Arsenal Twitter somehow managed to dig this up.
Of course they did. Of course they did.
It's amazing. But there are other things, like at the weekend, Bruno Fernandes throws a punch and there's no punishment. And Harry Mustafi, he stands on someone's leg and doesn't get any punishment. And the Tomiyasu incident and the MacArthur on Saka incident and things which we look at as Arsenal fans and know, we don't suspect, we don't fear, we know absolutely 100% that if an Arsenal player did what those players did, it is a red card. Like, no question. We do not ever get the benefit of the doubt in any of these situations, whereas other teams appear to get a bit more. And I think you're right to say Arsenal are seen as the red card team. It's easy to give a red card against Arsenal, and how we change that, I'm not 100% sure, to be honest. But yeah, we need to make sure we stay with 11 men as much as possible between now and May. That is for sure, though.
Yeah, and I think maybe there are lots of reasons. You know, we talked about in the past on here about quality of tackling, a ball winning. You know, are Arsenal good enough in that regard? I mean, one thing I think is really interesting is Burnley don't get bookings. And I think, yes, maybe that is partly perception. You know, they're a kind of rough and tumble team and, you know, it's just them being physical. But I think as well, it's the type of fouls. You know, if you're a team that are behind the ball, there's a certain type of foul you're making. Whereas Arsenal, I think a lot of the time, it seems to me the bookings we pick up are for kind of cynical stopping a counter-attack.
You know,
the kind of Man City fouls that, you know, Arteta famously validated on that Amazon documentary where he was kind of like, you know, I want the guys to bring them down early doors. And I just feel like sometimes with Arsenal, there's a kind of... maybe there's a lack of skill in the way they do that. But also, there's a target on our back now. And referees, I do think, do have a perception of us that is influencing decision-making. It has to stop, though, doesn't it? I mean, I have to, as much as I enjoyed Wolves, when Martinelli was sent off, at a position in the game where we weren't comfortable, but we were secure, you know, we were in the lead and had 11 men and had every chance, I think, of seeing it out. At that point in the game, I think Odegaard was sort of growing into it. Saka was growing into it. You know, I thought as much as Wolves might threaten, we would offer something on the break. I really feared that that would be the game and the points gone.
Yeah.
You know, and we can't sustain that at all going for the remainder of the season. I know that some of the sendings off have come in the cup competitions, but it is a troubling pattern nonetheless.
Yeah. I'm sure there will be some focus on that on the training ground and in the team meetings and the briefings and all of that kind of stuff where, you know, I think that's a really good point about the types of fouls. Because if you are beginning to become more of a front-footed team, which I think we are, I think there's been progress in that regard. And when you're playing against a team that is going to, you know, try and hit you on the counter-attack, you need to make those fouls sometimes. You absolutely need to make those fouls. I mean, I can remember one... Was it last season, the season before? I can't remember. I think it was Guendouzi actually rugby tackled somebody at one point. Yeah. He just flew through the air like some kind of
Grimondi.
Woolly Superman and hauled a guy down. And like, it's not subtle, but there are times where you do need to make those kinds of fouls. So it's trying to find the balance between, you know, how we deal with teams that are going to break on us and how we play the kind of football that we want to play. But that is obviously something Mikel Arteta and his coaching staff are going to have to fine-tune themselves on the training ground and going through those kind of scenarios. Because, like you said, in the Amazon documentary when Arteta was at Man City and he is talking to the three midfielders, I can't remember who it is, David Silva, De Bruyne and somebody else, Gundogan or one of them. And he is basically saying, if they go past you, foul them. You know, so this is something that they talk about. This is something that they prepare for. But, you know, we're not...
Maybe,
I don't know. But we're not very subtle. Like, would that be fair to say that as a...
Yeah, like, I think that's right. I think we're clumsy sometimes. Yeah. And I think there is a skill to making those fouls in the most subtle, least egregious fashion. The way in which you walk away from the incident, even, I think, can determine if you get booked. And perception is part of it. And again, to come back to that point of emotion, I think that's the other thing we can do. I think if you take emotion out of challenges, then generally you're safer. I mean, if I think about Gabriel sending off against Man City, you know, emotion was kind of the primary driving force there. I think if you look at some of the Xhaka instances, you know, I think that clearly has played a part in him leaping into stuff he shouldn't have leapt into. And that is that I do think is going to be so fascinating, because I love this team, actually. I would rather have this kind of emotional, connected, invested team. But we're not cold-blooded killers. No. That's what we're definitely not. And the degree to which we need to be between now and May will be interesting, I think.
Do you think that is something that we can develop?
Because maybe that's experience. Yeah.
Because like someone like Xhaka is never going to be a master of the dark arts. You know, he's he's not, when it comes to not being subtle, he is the absolute king of not being subtle. And even the booking he got against Wolves the other night was a perfect example of that, where the guy's running past him and Xhaka is kind of standing there and the shirt is getting longer and longer and longer. You're going, oh my God. I mean, will you ever learn? And he won't. So that's fine. That is what it is. And he is who he is and everything else. But I do wonder if certain other players might be a little bit better at it, you know, as time goes on, where, like, if Kieran Tierney starts to do it, is the referee going to look at Kieran Tierney with his shirt tucked in and his nicely parted hair and everything else and think about him in the same way as, you know, Granit Xhaka, or, you know, somebody who is perceived anyway as a more, what's the word I'm looking for here? More of a foully bastard. I can't think of exactly what I was going to say, but
yeah, I think that can come with time, can't it? I mean, if you think about, for the second podcast in a row, I'm going to mention Stefan Lichtsteiner, but when you think about defenders kind of over 30, well, any Arsenal defender over 30, really, they, you know, you do associate that kind of know-how with it, and I do wonder if people like White and Gabriel will develop that over time. Tierney to an extent. I hope so, because as much as all that emotion is a huge positive force, you know, the ability to be a kind of cerebral assassin at times is really significant and key. And we need a balance, basically.
Yeah.
We need a balance.
Well, yeah, it'll be fascinating to see how it plays out, and hopefully we can avoid red cards. Anything else from the weekend you want to talk about before we go to part two?
I don't think so, really. I mean, honestly, I just thoroughly enjoyed watching all the other results come in. I sort of couldn't believe it. You know, when Leicester pulled into the lead ahead of West Ham, but even when West Ham got a late equaliser, I wasn't deflated by that. I think with this race being so tight, the difference between 3 points and 1 point is massive. You know, draws for other teams, yes, please, I'll take those all day long, especially against out-of-form teams like Leicester. So, yeah, just really thrilled. I mean, our sort of situation improved without playing over the past couple of days. Actually, it's quite relaxing. If we could do that, if we don't have to play any games between now and the end of the season... I'll take that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the, around the 85th minute of the Wolves game, I was looking for another mid-season break, to be perfectly honest with you. The stress was too much for me. But yeah, it is nice when we can make some kind of progress without playing at all. But this weekend, we're going to have to, you know, do the football thing and hopefully continue to make that progress. Okay, we will take a break right here and we'll come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog. Also on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. Hurrah! I did it without fucking it up for about the first time in a month. So well done me. Do you want to go first on the questions?
Yeah, why not? We've had a few questions about something called a Super Bowl, which took place last night. And right. Unicorns of Saka, who's at Arsteta on Twitter, says, did seeing Stan Kroenke hold aloft the biggest prize in American sports give you any renewed hope that KFC have what it takes to drive Arsenal to the top of world football again?
Oh, I suppose what you would have to say first and foremost is that KSE are, if you said they had an area of expertise, it would be US sports, right? So I'm not sure you can really drive
It's a very different competitive landscape.
It is. There was a video doing the rounds. Let me just, I think if I can find it here. Let me put it. I replied to it. M. Berland, at Mark Berland, posted a video on Twitter of an interview with Josh Kroenke, and he was talking about all kinds of stuff, but he was talking about Arsenal and the Super League and all that. I'll put a link to the video in the show notes so people can have a look. And if you go and look at it on YouTube, it's, you know, you can jump in at the point where he's talking about Arsenal. You don't have to listen to him talking about basketball or any of that if you don't want to. I mean, he's a good talker. I still am quite cynical about some of the Super League stuff and some of the explanation around it, but he seems to think that, you know, he made a mistake and he's held his hands up to make that he's made a mistake and that he can learn from it and all of that kind of stuff. But I'm not sure what the Rams winning the Super Bowl actually means for Arsenal. I don't know
the
that
ramifications.
The ramifications, yeah. It's always seemed to me like the KSE sports teams, franchises, however you want to call them, have been quite middle of the road. Like, I'll stand to be corrected on this by American sports fans because, you know, I don't claim to have any expertise whatsoever in any of the sports that they're involved in. But winning the Super Bowl is obviously a fairly huge thing. So the investment that they made in the team and in the coach and all that kind of stuff, and the stadium as well, looks to have paid off. I suppose the people of St. Louis won't be as happy about it, though, considering how much they got fucked over by KSE and all the rest. So I don't know. It's one of those where I'm just not invested in it at all, really. And I don't really think it has any bearing on what Arsenal can do or will do. I think it's just its own separate thing. But maybe the experience of winning something, Stan and Josh might decide, hey, this is good. We like this. Let's have a bit more of it across the board.
I think that's about the best we can hope for as Arsenal fans. Yeah. I don't think financially it has much impact. Interestingly, I haven't watched the Super Bowl yet, but I gather that the owners get to lift the trophy first
really?
Before the coach or the players. Yeah.
That's weird.
Which, yeah, I mean, I hate to break it to them, that ain't ever going to happen in the UK. But so, yeah, I guess they will have sort of tasted that glory and that success, albeit one that they've achieved at huge financial cost in terms of the stadium and other expenses. I don't necessarily see it as an immediate thing. Now they pivot to the Premier League, you know, and next, the Champions League. but I do think that, again, I don't have the full background on this, but I have seen a couple of tweets flying around this morning suggesting that KSE's competitive record is at least improving across other sports too. And there are some people who see some parallels in the kind of executive and management and coaching structure of the Rams and Arsenal. You know, the guy who's just lifted the Super Bowl for the Rams becomes the youngest coach to ever do so. Obviously, at Arsenal, they've invested enormously in a young coach too. I think it will give them maybe some conviction that their kind of project idea that they're sort of rolling out across different sports might have some validity. But I don't see it having much tangible on-field benefit to Arsenal. I mean, the real step for Arsenal to make, whether it is this year or next year, and we all hope it's this year, is to get back into the Champions League. You know, we don't need to win the Super Bowl right now. That's not the position that we're in. That's not what we're thinking about. Arsenal need to take that step of getting back into the Champions League, the revenues that come with that, the status that comes with it. I think the commercial revenue that will follow, I just think that's very, very clearly the next sort of point in the project. And yeah, it's tantalising. It really is. And I, yeah, as for the Super Bowl, no, I don't think it bears much relevance. But yeah, listen, I think honestly, the as I said, the thing we can hope most is that Josh develops more of a taste for success, sporting success, than perhaps his father has demonstrated. And I don't preclude that as a possibility. I mean, he, like you say, he talks a good game.
Yeah, he does. He is a good talker. He reminds me a little bit of Ivan Gazidis in that way, that there's a lot of talking, and then you get to the end of it and go, oh, what did he say there? What was it?
Yeah.
But, you know, he's a young guy, and clearly he's the KSE guy at Arsenal. Stan and Josh are on the board, but it seems to me like he's the one who's most involved. So we'll see. We will see. Here's a question. I know we talked about a bit towards the end of the first half, but a couple of questions on the Discord, more about the refereeing and Mikel Arteta's comments after the Wolves game. Joe Yeti says, as much as we love to see Arteta call out the PGMOL, do you think this is going to end up having a negative impact because he's called them out? I don't think he necessarily called them out. He said we want to have some conversations with the officials. I think that's what he said. And then Kieran E. on the Discord as well, he said, the follow-up to this, could it get worse given the microscope we seem to be under? It's that weird balance, isn't it? If you put some pressure on a referee before a game, the old Fergie mind games, and even Wenger did it from time to time, where, you know, you talk about something and the referee, does he then become a self-fulfilling prophecy, or is he a bit more lenient, et cetera, et cetera? How do you think that will go down, given those lines of communication?
I mean, it could go the other way. It could backfire. They're a sensitive bunch, I think. I mean, ultimately, they are human, and we talk about the emotion in the Arsenal players, but they are subject to the same whims. They're not robots, ultimately, and I think criticism can backfire. But I think we have to try and put a bit more faith in the process than that, as difficult as it is, otherwise we'll just lose our minds. We have to hope that those conversations can be constructive. I mean, on a similar theme, Scott Mack on Twitter said, I know you'll both hate this, but how do we actually deal with the current refereeing situation? I'm not one for conspiracies, but it's clear this year more than ever some individual refs are holding Arsenal to different standards. I found it interesting. Arteta, after the game, said he's running out of ideas.
Yeah, I think that was a bit tongue-in-cheek, though. You know, there was a subtext to that comment about, like, well, what can I do when this is, like, out of my hands?
I mean, what can he do, though, Andrew? Like, do you have any bright ideas. I mean, we joked about sort of, you know, could you practice fouls? But what I'm at a loss, really.
I suppose the thing that you would say is, one, like, we have to acknowledge that at times Arsenal have been a bit naive or stupid or not particularly subtle, as we talked about in the first half of the show. But also, there are moments where players are going to get booked. That is just the reality of football. It's how we manage those moments, how those players manage the games when they're on yellow cards, which I think the other night they did pretty well. Like, Shaq and Partey booked before halftime. I can't lie and say that I wasn't worried. I was. But they managed the game well, both of them. They didn't do anything stupid. They didn't give the referee another decision to make. And as experienced players, that's what they can do. So I don't think you can just, you can't never get booked again. I don't think that's realistic. But when you are booked, don't do anything stupid. And I know some people will say, well, that's what Martinelli did, but he didn't know he was going to be booked. You know, I don't think, even if you say those were two yellow card incidents, he had any kind of precedent in his own career or watching the Premier League or playing in the Premier League for the last 2.5, 3 years, like, nobody's seen it before. So why would he consider the idea that he was going to be booked? And what he was doing was, if it was misplaced, he was still showing the kind of commitment that the manager is looking for when a player runs past you. It's like, chase him down, stop the attack, you know, prevent the danger, all of that kind of stuff, which is part of their preparation, I'm sure. But it is, there's going to be an element of a referee doing something in one game that he doesn't do in another game, and that's going to drive us mad. But all we can do is control how we behave and how we respond as and when we face situations when we're down to 10 men or all the rest. Beyond that, I don't know what we can do, really.
I heard quite a compelling case, and I'm going to horribly paraphrase it now, that Elliot made on the Arsenal Vision podcast. He was talking about, you know, is there a conspiracy theory? Is there a conspiracy around Arsenal's red card shame, as it were? And he was talking about how, you know, there basically aren't many red cards in football. They're a relatively low incident thing. You know, you're talking about a handful of incidents across a multitude of games. And so it's difficult to extrapolate from that there is a genuine agenda there. It was on their most recent episode. It's worth a listen. But I do think that what Arsenal could do better is kind of smell a red card being in the offing. You know, I know that that doesn't fit with, we just want consistency from referees, but I don't think you're ever going to get absolute consistency from human beings. And I do think sometimes the temperature of a game goes up, the pressure on a referee mounts, and sometimes what you just need to do as a player is say, just don't do anything stupid for 5 minutes, you know, just till the heat's gone out of it. And I think that, again, is something that comes with cool-headedness, with experience. You know, not every foul is judged the same. You can make an identical challenge in the 30th second of a game and the 30th minute, and they will be judged differently.
Yeah.
And there are all kinds of dynamics affecting a football match at any one time. It has its own internal politics, and Arsenal just need to be a bit smarter, I think.
There was a good,
that's a big part of it.
Yeah, there was a good comment here on the Discord from Willoa, who said it's probably too late, but I noticed Connor Cody talking quite a lot to Michael Oliver in the tunnel before the game, while Lacazette and the other Arsenal players were just staring straight ahead. Now, there's nothing wrong with this, but should the ability to work, in inverted commas, with a referee and get them onside be something we should consider when appointing the next club captain? And I do think there is something to that, that maybe the, deliberately or otherwise, that referees are probably going to be a bit more open and communicative with English players.
Mm.
And given that we do have Aaron Ramsdale between the sticks, we've got Ben White, we've got Kieran Tierney, Scottish, of course, before anyone says otherwise. Bukayo Saka, Emil Smith Rowe. You know, there is an inverted commas homegrown element, a substantial one, a core of that to our team, and maybe that is something that we can use to our advantage to ensure that maybe when something does happen, we get the benefit of the doubt. We do get the benefit Absolutely. Of the doubt, whereas, again, it's not a personal thing or even deliberate, but like if a referee feels like he doesn't have any connection with, let's say, Lacazette, and it's not a criticism of Lacazette, it's just the reality of nationality in the league that you're playing in. Like I would expect in Spain, a referee to have a greater connection with a Spanish player than with an English player who went over to play there, for example, or a French player or you know, whatever else. That seems normal to me. That aspect
and
of it
what
is,
England captains get away with.
Exactly. And that's
we just
not,
need the armband on one of our boys.
Yeah, but I mean, that's part of it, you know? It is part of it because it goes back years and years and years to like Alan Shearer trying to kick Neil Lennon's head off and he didn't even get a booking for it. Can I ask you this one then? Because it's sort of connected. AS37 Gooner, who said, assuming Lacazette does leave in the summer, who are your captain, vice-captain and third captain? And with the likely departure, I don't really want to talk about the experience. There's another part of that question, but I think this is the more interesting one. When you're looking at your leadership group, whatever you want to call it now, who's your captain, vice-captain and third captain going into next season?
It's interesting. Did you see the club put out an interview with Lacazette where he talked about potential captains? And he mentioned Gabriel, mm-hmm. but again, mentioned his English, as everybody does. He mentioned Ben White.
Yes, I think that's a very interesting one. Yeah.
Yeah. If Lacazette were to go and will not be a regular, let's discount him for a minute. I think I'd be looking... I mean, it's hard to look past those names. I'd probably throw Ramsdale in as one of the vices, as a contender. I just think, you know, a vice-captain goalkeeper, we've had a lot of success with that in the past, and there's something useful about the fact that they're always in the team. You know, they provide massive consistency. David Seaman did it for a long period of time.
I think Martin Odegaard as well is certainly a candidate.
Odegaard, yeah. Yeah. I think I would look to one of the centre halves. I do think Gabriel and Ben White make the most sense. And maybe, but based on the language thing, I would edge slightly towards Ben White, yeah, for number one. What do you think?
I think he's definitely a candidate. It could easily be Kieran Tierney as well.
Who's been with the club longer as well.
A little
if
bit
they
more
consider
experience.
That.
Not hugely older. I mean, they're more or less the same age, maybe a year older.
A long time.
But yeah, I think maybe Tierney is in that group. And if you're having a group that's four or five players, I think you've got to take Ben White, you've got to take Ramsdale just because of the personality as well. I think these guys are starting to emerge as leaders. We wondered, didn't we, you know, who is going to step up when the likes of David Luiz left, a fairly dominant personality for better or worse. Aubameyang is gone now, of course, as well. So that sort of cleared the decks a little bit in that sense. So I think it's going to be those. And then I also wonder if, as well, if you're thinking strategically, do you include Bukayo Saka in that group? Maybe not, I'm not talking about him as captain or anything like that, but as a really important player and as somebody whose future you want to tie down, just giving him that little bit of responsibility within that kind of a group might well be something that look, he's an Arsenal man and everything else, but just that greater inclusion into the team and how it operates and all the rest of it might be something to think about.
Yeah, I think so. I think And in fact, when Aubameyang went, you know, there were people close to the situation who thought Saka's name could even be a discussion as a potential captain at that point, which sounds surprising. But like you say, there might be a kind of strategic element to that. I think I agree. And the truth is, I wouldn't be unhappy with any of those players in any kind of order. And I suspect what it will be is a group, right? It's Odegaard, Gabriel, probably still Rob Holding, if he's still here.
Mm.
White, Tierney, something like that. In terms of actually who wears the armband, who is the captain, I have a slight bias towards the centre-halves, I think.
Yeah.
I just think, as much as I like Tierney, I think he's a more... I think they are more extroverted personalities, and I think there's something valuable in that. If you're choosing a guy as the kind of symbol, you know, the sort of rallying point, it's not the most significant thing, but I think it would make me edge towards those. But, you know, it's amazing that we've got a number of names in contention, given the overhaul in the squad and the fact we were sort of scrabbling around, like you say, wondering who these leadership figures might be.
Yeah. Maybe we don't want to take Tierney's focus off the long throw either as well, you know.
It's interesting that, you know. I think it was, I hate to out, but I think it was Stu, the photographer, who had the towel, certainly in the first half. I think he tossed KT the blue towel because I was on that side.
Brilliant.
Yeah, clearly they've worked on it. I mean, you know, Jova, who is the set piece coach, his responsibility is not only corners but throw-ins as well. And so I guess we're seeing this kind of evolution in what we're trying to do. I was like you. I heard on the Askcast with Andrew, you were saying, you know, sort of flashbacks of Stoke. I felt a bit uneasy about it. I have to say, I thought it was actually relatively decent. I was expecting it to be a bit of a disaster, but I thought the throw that the couple that Tierney produced was sort of vaguely dangerous. So I imagine we will see it again.
No, like, I think, look, it was slightly tongue-in-cheek with Andrew on the Arsecast on Friday, and what we did say was that, you know, given we do have some issues with goal scoring and we're a bit light up front, as we all know, maximising our goal-scoring potential, be it from set pieces, long throws, whatever it is, makes a lot of sense. So, you know, we'll wait and see how it goes.
Just on the subject of kind of cynicism and captaincy and cold-bloodedness, we didn't have a question specifically related to this, but I thought I'd mention it given that I watched the game at the weekend. Did you see what Cesar Azpilicueta did in the World Club Cup final?
No, I didn't. Explain.
So, Chelsea played Palmeiras in the World Club Cup final, and as I was with my dad and my brother, I was subjected to watching that. And they won with a penalty that was won in the final, I think, 4 minutes from the end of stoppage time.
Right.
And the penalty was awarded. Chelsea had a shot blocked, handball, VAR replay, it was awarded. And Azpilicueta was kind of talking, he's the captain of Chelsea, he was talking to the referee the whole time, saying, you know, it's a penalty, you know, I saw it hit his hand. In fact, when he gave it, he asked for the bloke to be sent off because he was like, he saved it, it was going in. But what he did was he picked the ball up and placed it on the penalty spot and lined up to take the penalty kick. And in the next 2 minutes, all the Palmeiras players were sort of all over him, you know, trying to get in his face, scuff up the spot, surrounding him, telling him he's going to miss.
What was
all that shithousing stuff? Well, no, you know, just it wasn't mental. It's just the normal stuff
right.
that you see when a penalty is about to be taken. But it was quite, you know, the goalkeeper getting in his face and, you know, just trying to put him off, trying to, throw him.
Right.
And then the moment before the penalty is to be taken, Azpilicueta walks away. And Kai Havertz, who has basically been stood on the halfway line, completely free, thinking about his penalty, with no Palmeiras players anywhere near him, strides up, takes the penalty, bottom corner, Chelsea win the Club World Cup.
Wow.
And I've never seen it done. And I just thought, that's what Arsenal, in an ideal world, could do with a bit of.
Oh.
You know, just that sort of complete cold-blooded calculation.
Mm. But you know, if we did that, whoever stepped up to take the penalty would, like, blast it out of the ground or something like that. Like maybe, the maybe. Like the Pires-Henry Man City thing, you know? But no, I know what you mean. Like, I like it.
You know, I have no fondness for Chelsea, no particular fondness for Azpilicueta, although I think he's a very good player. But, yeah, when you're looking for, like, what can a captain give you, or sort of what kind of on-field strategy can they actually impart, I thought that was really impressive, I have to say.
Yeah.
Even if saying that Chelsea are, inverted commas, world champions does make me feel slightly ill.
Nobody cares about that, though, do they? Does anybody really care?
Well, the thing is, Palmeiras really do. It's this funny thing where in South America, that tournament is incredibly prestigious. And, like, they were on their knees. On the subject of Chelsea, here's a question from Artin on Twitter, at Artin Nemoni. And Artin says, call me an optimist, but am I the only one thinking about top three?
I mean, why not think about it? I wouldn't. I mean, what's the league table situation? Let me just have a look.
Chelsea on 47. They played two games more than us. We are on 39. So if we
win
our
two games and then beat Chelsea,
be 2 points off.
Then we beat Chelsea.
Of course, at Stamford Bridge, yeah.
Easy peasy. Yeah, why not think about that? I don't know. Look, all you can do, as we've said, is just look at the next game and win the next game and win the next game and see where you go. I would worry maybe a little bit about that being... Look, I guess you... What is it they say? You should aim as high as you possibly can and see where you end up or whatever the fuck that is. Like, I think it's very optimistic. I do think it's optimistic, so I will call him optimistic. But why not? Why not have a think about it? I just think Chelsea are too strong, really, to let that kind of a lead slip at this point of the season.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I mean, obviously, I got the intel from the blue corner. And from what I gather, they're not playing especially well. I know they've obviously won this little mid-season tournament, but they've not been particularly convincing. I think they only beat their Middle Eastern opponent 1-0 in the semi-final, just edged this one on penalties. And I think in the league, they've not been great. There's things that aren't quite clicking for them as they were last season. They edged past Plymouth in the cup, didn't they, as well? Drew with Brighton. Yeah. I mean, listen, they're a very strong squad and they should absolutely finish third. I'm not really thinking about it. I mean, fourth would exceed what my expectations were coming into the season. So I wouldn't just bite your hand off. I would consume your entire body.
Wow. To get fourth right my now. Entire body. I mean, that would make this whole podcasting quite difficult.
I just do it on my own after that point.
Okay.
I would have subsumed you.
You have two heads. Like,
that's my plan. That's always been my plan, Andrew. Have I not mentioned God. That?
Yeah, now the true evil of the magpie fate is upon us, yeah.
Yeah.
Some gossiping women told you to do this, did they?
Yes, they were in my ear. Anyway, over to you. Have you got a question?
I do have a question, but I can't find it, so hang on one second. Okay, yeah, it comes from Lordy C, who's at Lordy C 85 on Twitter, and he says, do you think Gabriel Jesus is on Arsenal's striker list? Could be nothing, but seems to make sense. Worked with Arteta. Bit like Lacazette in style, but younger and better. If City sign Haaland, or somebody else, he may want to leave. And it's another Gabriel to add to the squad.
Yes, that's true. We would have to just call him Jesus, I guess. I mean,
don't fuck with the Jesus.
I hope he's on the list. I haven't heard his name. I don't know if that's just because we haven't considered it especially realistic. I mean, he'll have a year left on his Manchester City deal in the summer. And they will probably sign a centre forward. They tried very hard to last season. I think he'd be a terrific signing, I have to say. And not only can he play through the middle, he can play in wide areas as well. He's played on the wing a lot for City. this season. They play that kind of weird strikerless system. He can press. He scores goals. He's the right age. He's Brazilian. We've had a decent track record with those recently. Got a nice little gang of Brazilians for him to come into already. I'd love that signing.
Six goals, nine assists this season.
Nine assists is very decent, isn't it? I mean, maybe that's because he's been playing
eight in the Premier League
wide right quite a lot, which is not where we need somebody. But yeah, as a kind of mobile centre forward, I think he's a really attractive option. I mean, I'm sure Manchester City will try to keep him. It's just whether, you know, Mikel can get in his ear and promise him lots and lots of minutes.
I mean, he would get lots and lots of minutes if he joined this Arsenal team. If Lacazette goes and Nketiah goes, he would get lots of minutes for sure.
And he'll be thinking about Brazil, you know, as most Brazilian footballers do. I mean, and he'll be thinking about what's best for his international career. If he fears he's not going to play much at City. I mean, 15 Premier League starts. It's not bad at all at this point of the season. He's been very, very involved. Might be a bit pie in the sky. But yeah, listen, I would... I'm just trying to think. I've bitten someone's hand off. I've eaten someone's entire body. What would I do for Gabriel Jesus? I'd probably regurgitate you and eat you again.
Would it be like... Would I come back to life like Terminator 2 where they melt the guy?
Yes.
They melt the guy and he just comes back in. Oh, you want me to feel the pain of all these things?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's fine. I mean, it would be a shoddy experience without, you know, the... The torture being inflicted on somebody else when you consume their entire body, yes.
yeah, he'd be a great signing for any Premier League club, I think.
Let me ask you this one then. Similar kind of vibe. Freddie LJ on the Discord says, not that I've heard it mooted, but if we were willing to let Pepe go back to Lille in exchange for Jonathan David, is it a deal you'd consider for next season? Also, assume you'd agree that Pepe's race is run at Arsenal.
Yes, Jonathan Davis apparently is an international rugby player.
Is he?
Yeah, for Wales, unsurprisingly.
Sounds like.
Jonathan David, the Canadian footballer. Again, one that would make quite a lot of sense. I'll tell you the reason he's really interesting. So basically, last season, he went to Lille, having scored quite a lot of goals in Belgium, and it was ostensibly to sort of replace... Is it Osimhen? Osimhen? That very expensive...
Well, the guy who went to Napoli, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I might have my order of events added up. But basically, the expectation was he'd come into Lille and score a load of goals. He didn't, really. But what he did do was work incredibly hard off the ball. So his pressing, his ball winning, his ability to be a focal point for the team and kind of link the play was so good that Liverpool started looking at him very seriously as a possible successor to Roberto Firmino. And what I find compelling about Jonathan David is that this season, he's changed. He's doing a bit less of that and a lot more goal scoring. He's up in double figures for goals in Ligue 1. He was leading the top scorers. I'm not sure if he still is, but in a division with, you know, Mbappe and Messi and Neymar and a few others, that's no mean feat. And he's played a bit more like a poacher at times. And what that suggests to me is that at whatever he is, 23, something like that. Let's have a look at him now. Just better check my facts. 22 still, actually. And only just. He's someone who has quite a rounded game and has shown an ability to do kind of both sides of what we would be looking for from a centre forward. Now, can he put it all together? I don't know. But if you're talking about the type of centre forward I think Arteta might be interested in, I think his name has to be in the mix. And certainly Arsenal had watched him quite closely when he was in Belgium. I don't think he was on the radar in January at all, but if he keeps it up between now and the end of the season, why not? You've got to consider him, I think.
Yeah, he's one of the names that's doing the rounds, that's for sure. What about the potential of a Pepe swap? Is there an accounting trick we could use where, you know, whatever we still owe Lille is then whatever, I don't know.
We'll still be paying for Pepe, that's for sure. So maybe would he be up for that? Would he see that as regressive? Would he like it? I don't know. I suspect we'll hear a bit more about Jonathan David. I think if he can carry on doing what he's doing, there's going to be a lot of clubs looking at him.
Yeah.
And also, you know, he's... I just think that age, 22, and he won't be 23 till next January. I mean, he's really promising.
All right.
On the subject of strikers, I thought this was from Saul T. His name is actually Saul T. Airy Henry on the Discord. And they said, Voot Veghorst, 12 million. Isn't that the low-risk Plan B type of striker we could have got done in January?
I suppose we could have if we'd wanted to.
You have to imagine.
Like,
I mean, they didn't pay loads for him, Burnley. No. It was about 12 million, was it?
Yeah. Something like that. It feels like that is exactly the kind of Plan B striker we could have gone for if we'd wanted to, but didn't. Like, we didn't want to. So, I don't know. I mean, they made their decision in January. It's weird to sort of think about it at this point because, you know, we just have to get on with it. I mean, we did have a question about Eddie, and I can't find it exactly.
Just quickly on Veghorst, it is worth saying that Burnley gave him 3.5 years, and he's 29.
Well, then that's exactly what we shouldn't be doing. You know what I mean?
And then maybe we could have got him on a smaller contract, but I suspect the length of contract was a big factor in him making that move.
Yeah. We had a couple of questions. I'm seeing if I can find it here. Ben on the Discord, what did you make of Eddie's performance last week? Body language doesn't tell the whole story, but as the rest of the team worked incredibly hard to keep the 3 points, he seemed as though he couldn't be bothered. And Paul on Twitter, is that Gunnar Stifler, said, goodly morning. Eddie's cameo at Molineux lacked the urgency and energy of his teammates. Isn't it time to try someone else in this role of closing a game out?
Yeah. I've read a lot about Eddie on kind of social media and stuff, and a lot of people said they felt the body language was off. And I have to kind of accept that because I'm in the ground and, you know, you see things slightly differently. I didn't see it as an attitude problem. I just thought he played very poorly. That was my perception, that he came on and was not good at the job that we required from him. But then I am someone who generally, I think I do give footballers the benefit of the doubt. I tend to think that these highly competitive individuals rarely don't try. I think obviously there are other psychological factors that impede their performance. Could be motivation, could be contentment, could be morale, all these things. But very rarely would I think that a player in his position would come on and just not really make any effort. I sort of, and that wasn't, I have to be honest, that isn't how I saw it at the time.
Right.
I just saw it as a guy basically not playing well. What did you think?
I was just a little bit, like, I don't think he couldn't be bothered. I don't think that's fair. But I did expect a little bit more from him in terms of what he could have given in, just even physically. I mean, there was a moment really late in the game where he drove me mad because we'd won a free kick and we had the ball in the corner and he just needed to keep it there. And he played a ball straight to their goalkeeper, which went straight down the other end and they got a corner, which was like, what the fuck are we doing here? You know, and I think he's experienced enough and savvy enough to know that he should have just kept the ball in the corner, really. So I don't quite know what he was thinking in that moment. But I thought maybe we could get a bit more physically from him. You know, chasing across the line. I know you want to keep your shape and keep organized when you're down to 10 men. So maybe it was just, you know, stay in the zone where if something breaks, you can get
lock
to
stuff
it.
Off, look to win the second ball,
but
like that.
But, you know, it is one of those things where I think if you had another option, where if you had another player who was going to be at the club next season, you would use that before you would use a player who's heading into the final months of his contract.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'd say about the contract thing is Eddie Nketiah should be highly motivated to perform right now. I mean, I think he's in danger of not getting a particularly attractive move.
What if he already has a move that he is quite happy with? I mean,
well, that's a possibility. I mean, he can sign a pre-contract agreement with a foreign club, and that would affect your motivation, for example. I don't know, though, if that's true or not. I honestly have no idea. But yeah, that's. I guess we can't preclude that possibility. Mm. I mean, obviously, what were the options? The option was Pepe, I guess.
Yeah.
And I have to be completely honest and say when the change was made and I thought, right, what I'm looking for is a guy to basically shuttle across their defence, close stuff down, try and nick a ball here and there.
That's not what I think
I probably
of Pepe,
would choose. Yeah. Yeah, I probably would choose Nketiah over Pepe for that job. But he didn't do it well.
No, the other option is Martinelli, of course, and he was the guy who got sent off. So, you know, you could easily you could have put Pepe on. But again, I'm not sure Pepe is a down to 10 men player. Then again,
wouldn't play to his strengths. No.
Well, if you can counter, maybe it does. But it is first and foremost a rear guard defensive effort. Let's finish out with this one, though, because we mentioned Martinelli. Motza man Morris, he loves his Motza. He said, with Martinelli out next game, do we put Saka on the left and Pepe on the right? And Ozax, also on the Discord, said, are we going to see Emile Smith Rowe on the left in the next match?
I think, you know, barring any bad news, I think we are.
Yeah.
I think he's probably overdue a Premier League start. I can't think when he last started a Premier League game. It would have been December, certainly.
Yeah.
Maybe it was five, something. It wasn't even the Leeds game. So it was the 3-2 defeat to Manchester United on the 2nd of December.
Wow. Yeah, he's well overdue, isn't he? I know he has had injuries, but, you know.
Yeah, so I think he's well overdue. I think Pepe obviously gets bumped up the pecking order. I hope we will see Pepe against Brentford for 20, 25 minutes. Intrigued to see what we can get from him. I do think it will be on the wing rather than through the middle. I'm not sure Arteta I don't know. There's no indication that that's kind of in the plan at this point, but I guess we wouldn't know if it was.
I think it will be Smith-Rowe.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, he deserves that. I mean, he scored a lot of goals off the bench. Sort of, you know, if it weren't for the excellent form of Martinelli, he would definitely have been starting. So it's an opportunity for him to restake his claim and give Mikel something to think about.
For sure. All right. Well, look, we will leave it there for today. To you guys, thank you as always for listening. James, the nicest Valentine I've ever received is the knowledge that if it came right down to it, you would consume me while I screamed and flailed around. But, you know, this is part of the evil magpie plan. So I'm glad we have it out in the open now, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. It's better out in the open.
All right. We will catch you on the next one, folks. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.